Tasty, flavorful coffee comes from thriving farms. However, long-held industry standards leave most farmers scraping by, severely limiting their ability to grow quality coffee. But together, we can change that. Our direct-from-farm sourcing eliminates the many layers usually found between the farmer and you. This results in prosperous farms with the capacity to grow exceptional coffee. And great coffee is what makes all our days brighter. We invite you to be a part of a coffee movement where everyone is lifted. Joe Bean, coffee that lifts everyone.
Live from Rochester, this is Plants of Beats.
back home, if it's an event uptown and you got a problem with somebody in Southwest, you still might pop out to your event uptown.
Yeah.
But up here, if it's an event on the east side or the west side, and you got a problem with somebody maybe on even one of those sides,
it's a good chance that either they going to be there or somebody they know going to be there, and they gonna tell them.
For sure. For sure.
But the other part to that is about the Juneteenth thing. I just think the trauma for Black people in America is just so much deeper it's probably like a psychological thing to this, but like people who are like really into America and the idea of it and patriotism, I think they really, really get behind July 4th in a way of like, this is America's birthday and I love America. And I love, like, for non-Black people, it's probably an amazing thing because it represents everything that their ancestors came here for, right? Mm-hmm. Got on that boat, came to Ellis Island and America, America, America. And even for Black people, this is why I say I think Black people might go harder on July 4th. Black people who want to assimilate into that.
Yeah.
Just be part of the America and just be American instead of African American, right? Want to be a part of America. I think it's harder for us to like feel a sense of celebration and pride around a holiday that's just for us. I mean, we don't celebrate Kwanzaa.
Another thing, where is this like, do we think Kwanzaa's not cool?
Exactly. Now, we did kind of celebrate Kwanzaa growing up.
We did. And you know what? At the time, I swore it was just a cop-out because our parents was broke. I swore it was just a cop-out because they was broke that year. But it's crazy. As I got older and I look back at what each day was, I'm like, yo, this is a dope holiday.
Absolutely.
It's a dope holiday. And it's just... I don't know if we've been made to feel again or we made ourselves just feel like it's not cool.
I think it's both.
Or is it just doper? Do we feel just to load the tree up with presents every year instead of every day have a meaning behind one gift?
It's like, do you want to go to the party where it's just your class or do you want to go to the party where the whole school is there? And I just think it's that FOMO thing where it's just like everybody's celebrating Christmas and that's what all the movies are about. And that's what all the... I wonder if Jewish kids feel that. But I don't think so, though.
And parents always say, I don't want to hear my kids' mouth and them crying the rest of the year because they ain't get something and the other kids got something. So, you know, they put us between a rock and a hard place with the shit.
For sure.
But something I wanted to go back to when you was talking about how folks is proud to celebrate July 4th. And so when you have a certain demographic who have a high-paying job, live in a great zip code.
Okay.
Kids go to great schools where they get great educations. They have savings in the bank. They're not living check to check. Maybe even have some investments. Deal with very little to low trauma inside their unit of people that they call family when it comes to violent crimes. Mm-hmm. They're not being ground down to a pebble every day by life in America. So when holidays come like that, they have the reserves in them to be exuberant and celebrate. Mm. But when you have a demographic living check to check, kids going to bad schools, living in bad neighborhoods, don't have any savings, close family units are always affected by trauma and violent crimes, do they have the reserves to celebrate another holiday, so to speak?
Well, I think that's part of my point is like, what is there to feel proud about, right? Because a lot of times if you're in that situation, you can internalize and say, I live in a bad neighborhood. I go to a bad school. My family don't have no money because I'm Black.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody that goes to that school is Black. everybody that lives in that neighborhood is black. And everybody's going through that financial strain. So it's easy to pinpoint it on that reason and say, oh, my life is like this because I'm black. So, like, now you're telling me that I should celebrate a moment where, you know, my people were free. I don't feel as free as mm-hmm. the people in that other zip code, mm-hmm. right? So, I just think it's this psychological thing of, like, what is there to celebrate? Which is fucked up.
it is in itself. If we, just think about this for a second. Let me just throw this at you. If we actually lived and had an environment in a world like Wakanda, how fucking happy would we be to celebrate Juneteenth?
Juneteenth would be like.
It would be like it would fucking be like, Super Bowl. It would be like your team won the Super Bowl every year when it was time to celebrate Juneteenth. If we lived how they say we lived in Wakanda.
That's crazy.
So that's what society has done to us when it comes to wanting to celebrate a holiday about black people again. Like,
yeah.
It's like, what for, bro? It's we really still fucked up out here. So tell me, pinpoint and show me in my life, what am I celebrating about? You freeing me a couple hundred years ago, to which I'm still going through with y'all to this day.
Now let me bounce this at you. Do you think if we were still in an era where our athletes, our musicians and entertainers were like extremely pro-black and loud about it, almost like the 60s, 70s with those mm-hmm. athletes and those mm-hmm. musicians,
mm-hmm.
if mm-hmm. a group of people like that nowadays made it a big deal. Like, if you know how they used to have, like, the Rock Nation brunch
mm-hmm.
that you would see mm-hmm. on social media?
Right.
Or, like, all the BT award parties. Like, of Hove and Kevin Hart and LeBron and who else? Serena Williams and... And people like that got together and did like a
Eddie Murphy
and did like a big Juneteenth brunch that was like Met Gala-ish almost.
Mm-hmm.
I think that shit might trickle down to and made it a thing, made it like this celebration that they was going to take hold of. I think it would trickle down to people and people would start doing their own mm-hmm. kind of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't want to like discount to places like Buffalo or like, you know, I do see people trying. I don't want to discount that. I don't want to say it's everybody, right? Like there are, and it's probably shit we don't know that's happening around the country where people are trying to do exactly what we're talking about right now. But it's not widespread. It's not what 4th of July is. It's not what these other celebrations are at all. All right. No, go ahead.
I got a crazy thing that always comes back to me is I think that the progress in whole in a positive direction of society died around those three deaths. King, X, and Kennedy.
Which Kennedy?
President.
President, not Bobby, not his brother.
Not so much Bobby, but the president. Once those three went down, all progress for this country pretty much. Those was like our golden years. After that, things pretty much switched to a one-sided thing, man. So I think if we did have athletes and entertainers like those in the 60s and 70s who played sports but also used their platforms to actually speak and wasn't so scared of the backlash, that we would have maybe more of a movement behind a holiday like that.
Yeah, I mean, look at the message that they probably sent to anybody who wanted to speak up and use their voice to change things. It's just, I mean, not just them three. I mean, Fred Hampton, you know, Medgar Evers. I mean, all the shit that they did to disrupt the Black Panther Party. Take it to sports, right? Like mm-hmm. Muhammad Ali, they took his boxing license mm-hmm. for 3-4 years. the dudes that and forgive me because I can't remember their names right now. Dudes, they put their fist up at the Olympics, like they lost their careers after they did that.
For sure.
So, the things that was happening to deter that energy at that time, people probably said, "Well, no, I'm not. I'm not gonna lose my life or my money or my this or my that to." And what we talk about them doing now is nowhere near the stance that they was taking back in the 60s.
Nowhere near.
But it just, somewhere along the line, it didn't become cool to be so pro-black. Even in the early 90s, I feel like with a lot of the rap groups, you know, Public Enemy, Tribe, or De La Soul, I mean, even like NWA to on a different spectrum, was just more like, I don't know, like pro-black, right? Like, am I tripping about that? Like,
nah, it was some messages to black folks in there that was telling them that, yo, it's a program being ran on you. Wake up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Be proud and be better. You know what I'm saying? And they wiped that out with gangster rap. And that's the music that brainwashed me from about the age about 9 until about 17. That's the music that brainwashed me.
What you mean when you say brainwashed? That's interesting.
That's the music that brainwashed me, I would say, to the point is that when you don't have an older male in your life to tell you right from wrong, at that age, when I'm listening to Snoop and Dre and Mobb Deep and M.O.P., and cats like that, I'm thinking everything they talking about, they really doing. Mm. So I'm interpreting that as, you know what I'm saying, I gotta be on the same type time. So now, you know, everything, if I want to do music or even like their music, I gotta do what they talking about. So I was brainwashed by a lot of this gangster rap music coming up. You know what I mean? It was certain cats like Pac, who was like an older brother who would drop some jewels and some music, who would try to tell you something. Jay-Z did it, I mean, coming later along, but it was a big gap in there with gangster music where, man, they was just telling you, you know what I'm saying, go out here, bust your gun, sell crack. You know what I'm saying? So that's what we thought you were supposed to do. That's what we... So that 90s crime wave that ran through Philadelphia, man, you know what I'm saying? I just saw the mayor of Philly say something that was crazy. He said that Philadelphia...
The current mayor, Sherelle.
Oh, no. This was the last mayor, the white dude. No, he not the mayor. What is the white dude?
Oh, Krasner. You talking about the DA.
The DA.
Yeah.
So I just heard the DA say something crazy. He said that in Philadelphia, I think it was the month of March they was talking about. They was in March. And he said that they only had 36 homicides so far by the month of March. He said that was the lowest number since 1975.
Wow.
50 years we've been killing each other in the hundreds in that city. For 50 years, from 75 to 2025, we've been killing each other in the hundreds down there. Like, and it's, when you think about that, you really got to think that literally, just quick math, 40 to 70,000 black men is gone out of Philadelphia over the last 50 years. 40 to 70,000. That's probably more, but it's just quick math. You know, averaging 300 to 450 homicides a year for 50 years. Yeah, that's a lot of black men. And you throw Philly in there, New York in there, Chicago in there. Man, you start to add it up over 50 years, you maybe talking about 900,000 black men dead in 50 years in all these cities in America just from gun violence. 900,000. A lot of dudes could have been CEOs, ball players, rappers. You know what I mean? A A lot of nice dudes got killed over all them years. A lot of nice dudes. So
shit, that's all the people we need right there for Juneteenth.
That's all the people we need right there for a revolution.
Yeah.
Check the show notes. You'll find more information about today's guests, tips for caring for our feature plant, and a few special links connected to the episode. Thank you.
So I want to bring up your plant.
All right.
So for you, I chose the hemp plant.
Aha! And you know what? Go ahead, break it down, because there's some things about the hemp plant that I'm learning more as the years go on.
So it's a fast-growing annual cannabis sativa plant, legally defined by its chemical makeup rather than its appearance. Mm. The defining characteristic of hemp is that it contains 0.3% or less THC, making it non-intoxicating, while it is frequently rich in CBD.
Mm.
Typically grows very tall, ranging from 4 to 15 feet. When cultivated for fiber, it grows in a single unbranched stalk with minimal foliage at the bottom, resembling a bamboo stalk.
Mm.
It's an annual plant growing from seed to harvest in about 60 to 120 days, depending on the region. And unlike drug-type cannabis, hemp can be grown in dense, crowded fields or space further apart. Now, reason why I picked it for you is because it says, while the crunchy, unhulled seed that it produces has a tough shell that can be difficult to chew, the soft inside is a nutritional powerhouse. And I think how I would describe your personality, someone who's known you my whole life, is you have a very hard exterior. But once you get past that exterior, I think that people that do get past the hard exterior grow to love you because you have very soft inside to you.
Mm.
That's very, I mean, this says nutritious, but I think people like to talk to you. People like to be around you. People like to laugh with you. But they got to get past that hard exterior. Do you think is that accurate?
I think that's very accurate, man. I've been told a lot of times that I seem unapproachable. and when the person told me that, you know, I always try to smile a lot more when I'm out in public to make people feel like I am approachable. But I've had people, you know, say that, you know, I wanted to come up and say something to you, but I just didn't know what to say.
Hmm.
And I guess, you know, if I was coming up to somebody like myself, I guess I wouldn't want to come up and just say any fucking thing either. I'm guessing I would want to pick my words right, too. You know what I mean? But, you know what I mean? I don't want to be, you know, viewed as a unapproachable, mad, disabled black man, because I've met them before, and it's like, I understand how they got there, but you make it that much harder for people to want to work with you and help you when you're like that, you know? And I've been there before, you know, and I've thought I've had justification for being that type of person. So I've been there before, but you know what I mean? It's no way to live being, you know what I mean? And an angry all the time person, you know what I'm saying? No matter what it is that has you angry, it's no way to live.
I think angry black man is, I wouldn't call it a stereotype. I think it's a reality. But the funny thing is, I've been told that too.
Mm.
And like me, you couldn't be any more different
when
it comes to like.
So you feel like it's a cop out.
No, I don't feel it's a cop out. I think it's a black man thing.
Mm.
And I think it's an inner city black man thing where you develop a hard shell for protection.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get rid of that. Right? You don't want to be walking down the street looking like you sweet.
Yeah.
Because you get tried where we grew up.
Yeah. True. Back to Black-ish, because that's my shit. It was an episode where Dre was like, yo, the white woman at the supermarket flipped me the bird and took my parking spot. Like, I don't even got my black man anger switch no more to make people respect my G. He was like, I'm even losing that. So I guess it is like a thing that you grow up with and you flip on and off in situations, whether for survival or whether for to get the upper hand, yeah. or whether because you feel uncomfortable, or you know what I mean? I guess it is something that you switch on and off that other people that don't come from such highly pressurized backgrounds don't ever develop that type of growl to them, so to speak.
Like, I feel like Zayd is not going to have that.
And it's like, do we bust our ass in the world so our kids don't have to have that?
Yeah.
Because my son doesn't have that.
Yeah.
But I worked hard to make sure that when I was doing my shit that I was doing out in the world, he ain't know nothing that was going on. I never showed him nothing he didn't need it to see. Never talked about nothing around him he didn't need it to hear. So I went out my way purposely so he wouldn't have that, so to speak, in him, because I know how it can hold you back.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, it's that whole, I feel like a lot of black fathers, just to bring it back to fatherhood, kind of have that dilemma of like, how much is too much of like making sure your kid, specifically if you have a black son, it's like you don't want him to be exposed to certain shit that you was exposed to growing up in the city. But then it's like moments where it's just like, oh, well, this boy ain't gonna know how to deal with this, deal with that, overcome this, overcome that.
Right.
A little bit of adversity to shut down. Like, it is how much is too much?
It is a tight rope to walk, because some things you lose when they don't. You feel like some things they lose in character when they don't have that in them for certain situations.
Yeah.
But you feel like in the long run, it'll help them. I mean, it's certain similar to like how in the late 70s and early 80s, all our moms was giving us names, John, Michael, Robert, David, Donald, Tom, because they ain't want us to have hard problems getting jobs.
Yeah.
So they gave us all basically white dudes names. Until black moms like, man, this shit ain't working out. Either way, fuck that. Daquan, Daquavius, you know what I mean? They switched the shit up. So it was the same thing, that black parents didn't want us to go through what they went through, so they gave us all white sounding names.
Yeah.
So it's similar to that.
It's true. It's funny.
But now, do you have a disadvantage when you go in the room and you tell niggas your name is Robert and I'm Mike and you got a nigga named Daquavius and a nigga named John Tavius over here? Are we looking less black than them because our names sound less black?
I don't know how
that
works.
You see what I'm saying? So it's like, in the long run, did you getting that name help you? Was it more disadvantage around other black people because your name wasn't as black? Or in the long run, did it help you not having an as black name? It's a toss-up.
I think it was less the name and more like little shit. Like, it's fucked up, but you know, you get teased, but like, it's funny, like, people will be like, oh, well, you know your dad, or like,
like, black or like, people, we get on each other this nigga had a nerve to have a mom and dad in the house.
Yeah, like.
Like, damn, bro. They stayed together. I don't, you what know? The fuck? I don't know.
And then mom bought that big ass house and like, people in high school thought I was rich, and I had to tell people, like, I mean, I had to make sense of it myself. I'm like, because I didn't know how much she paid for that house. I know how much work she put into it, how fucked up it was when she first bought it. And it wasn't like what people eventually walked into. But I think it was Dave Chappelle who said, like, I think he said this. Don't quote me, but he was saying that his mom bust her ass so he could grow up poor around white people. And it's almost like that. It's just like, no, like, we not rich, but like, mom worked hard as shit.
That's
for us to just.
Yeah, that was a dope way to put it.
Be level.
Yeah. Just, just to be level. Just
to be level.
Just to not feel like she wasn't living check to check.
Yeah.
Just to not feel like, damn, we really don't got shit. Just to not feel like we in here living on top of each other, you know, with scraps and stuff like that. Just to not feel like that. You right.
So you said you got a 10-month-old daughter.
Yeah, man.
Do you envision raising your daughter differently than you raised your son?
You know, I had my son. I was 17 years old. And I done turned the clock back. And I just had my daughter. I was 42 years old. So I've learned a lot in that gap of years about parenting. I've looked at some of the ways I did good and some of the ways I didn't do good with my two older kids. So this child, there's going to be some differences.
Stuff.
Yeah, some non-traditional stuff. Like I even did that, put the Mozart on the belly shit with this child. I didn't do that with my other kids. And you know, with Nassim, I was only around him till he was about maybe like 2 or 3 months old. And then I went away and I ain't come back till he was like 2 years old. And then with Cheyenne, she came into my life. She was probably almost 2 years old. So this gap that I'm seeing right now with my daughter from birth all the way up until 10 months, it's a lot of this stuff I never saw before. I wasn't there for it. So this is the first time I'm seeing all this stuff. So it's been pretty dope.
When you say went away, are you comfortable sharing with that?
I was 17, so that's when I had my juvenile incarceration phase where they sent me to Danville Secure Treatment Facility for about 20 months. And I went out there and got that all done and didn't learn my lesson when I was out there. Not at all. Came back, jumped right back into the same shit. But, yep, so I missed that gap with him. So getting to see that. I think I only got to change like one diaper with Nassim, and I think that was like, yeah, I think I only got to change maybe like one or two diapers with Nassim. I'm changing diapers like a motherfucker with this.
Some beats, make sure you subscribe and leave us a rating. It helps more people find the show, but more than that, it helps us keep building this little community around music, plants, wellness, and good conversation. Every listen, every rating, every share helps keep the roots growing. We'll be right back.
being paralyzed and shot at 18, I went through a lot of shit with the healthcare system, with the justice system, with the housing system, with government benefit system, just with all the systems that people with disabilities bump up against. And I got to a point where I got in some circles where people were willing to listen to my story and hear what I had to say. And I realized that being a self-advocate was cool, but I had to advocate for other people so they wouldn't go through what I went through. So through that, just trying to work for other organizations is kind of how I started. But I wouldn't see people that necessarily looked like me, who I felt like came from where I came from and got paralyzed how I got paralyzed. I wouldn't see a lot of them. And I knew they was out there, but they just wasn't showing up to these functions that I kept ending up at for people with disabilities. So I decided that I would try to start my own organization and nonprofit to try to help individuals who've been paralyzed by violent crimes in the inner city. And lo and behold, there's, you know, there's a good amount of them that's in the city of Rochester. And, you know, a lot of the times the resources that come through from federally and statewide don't always trickle down to people in our neighborhoods just because of lack of knowing about resources, lack of education about the resources, or just a lot of times the ugly fact is, you know, because of housing instability, a lot of us come out of these rehab units and kind of fall off the map because it's hard to keep track with us. So, you know, it's hard to let a person know that some benefits might be available when, you know, their phone number might be off every other month, or they're not living at the same address they was a few months ago. So it's a lot of things that come into that. So I know one of the top things we want to help people with is the housing instability that people with disabilities face in Rochester and in other cities in America, because it's hard to ask people to, you know, it's hard to ask people what do they feel like they have to contribute back to society or their community when, you know, they can't take a shower every day or go to the bathroom when they need to go there, or just have somewhere, you know, safe and warm to sleep every night. So I know we got to get people's housing situated first and foremost before we can get them to try to start working on a lot of other things that come with trying to get some normalcy back in your life after you've been disabled.
Would you say that you come across a lot of people in this situation that are similar in the sense that they have these kind of hardened exteriors because of what happened to them, and you have to like break through?
You know, I do, but I think that it's like some type of magic that happens when two people in wheelchairs start talking to each other, because there's no ego there. There's no facade. There's no, I'm doing better than you, you're doing better than me type thing. We both know we're in fucked up situations. We both know we going through something. So it's no fraud in there. So they can talk to me real plainly about what they going through, and I can talk to them real plainly about what I've been through and maybe some things that I can help them with. So it's like, you know what I mean? It's a different type of magic that happens when two people with disabilities talk to each other compared to when two regular people talk to each other. Because you got to think, when two regular people are talking to each other, in that interaction, no one person wants to seem lesser than the other person. So y'all are constantly, you know, in little milliseconds, you're doing things and hearing things from each other, that you're sizing each other up. You're thinking of things that instead of Letting the person speak, you're responding as if, oh yeah, you know, I did that too, bro, because I got one of them. You see what I'm saying?
It's a lot of posturing.
It's a lot of posturing that go back and forth between two regular people. When you got two people with disabilities, no posturing. There's no need to posture.
Because everything is kind of out for you to see.
Right. There's no band-aid I can put on what's going on for you to be like, that's not going on with me today. Yeah. I'm okay. I'm having a great day. There's none of that. So it's a very easy, like, to and fro of a conversation with people with disabilities. You know, one thing that I don't notice that I guess I didn't notice when it was happening is that the experience I had, you know, living on 66 was not an experience most people have with disabilities. Having an elevator, being able to get from one floor to the next, being able to fly down a ramp and jump in one of two cars, both with hand controls, and leave and come whenever I want. A lot of people don't get that experience.
Yeah.
And I think because I had that experience and I had friends that still came around, it put me in a different space and it allowed me to do and be and try things that most people don't in this disability life.
Wow.
You know, I talk to a lot of people and they little circle of friends evaporate within the first year that they was hanging out with after they get paralyzed. And I'm still talking to people 30 years later, you know, that's been with me since I've got, you know, paralyzed, that knew me before and still hang with me after. So I've been kind of blessed in certain situations to have support groups and just independence in ways that allowed me to live in a way that I can share my experiences with other people and say, you know, this is possible for you.
Wow. What's the name of the organization?
MPP360. You can check us out at MPP360.co.
Last question. Do you smoke hemp? Have you ever smoked hemp?
The question is, can you smoke hemp?
Yeah, you can smoke hemp.
I thought hemp was
it's CBD,
more,
pretty much.
So it's CBD. I think I've rubbed CBD on. I don't know if I've ever smoked CBD. I've rubbed it on though, and I feel like it's helped before. I'm actually rolling up now with some hemp papers, which is not too bad.
So that's pretty much smoking it.
Yeah. You know, I would like to get to a place one day where I could have somebody make me like some t-shirts and shit out of some hemp, man. That'd be dope because you can do stuff like that. Hemp. That's what I heard.
a playlist featuring lo-fi music from Alo-Fi. You can find more beats on all streaming platforms by searching Alo-Fi. Plants and Beats is produced by Rob Bell with music by Alo-Fi. Subscribe to stay updated and follow Rob Bell and Alo-Fi on social media. The information is in the show description. Peace and blessings. See you next week.